Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. M. Greg Block, author of The Hippocratic Myth. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about how the military is using telemedicine in its healthcare efforts. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea comes from an organization called Cycle Kids that's been using bicycles to help kids stay active and healthy for over 6 years. The Cycle Kids program centers on a unique curriculum whose lessons in bicycle skills and safety engage children in the broader discussions about exercise and healthy eating. The curriculum's specific goals include teaching children not just how to ride a bike, but bike safety skills, basic bike mechanics, the importance of an active lifestyle and a healthy diet, and the environmental science behind pollution-free transportation. In the past 6 years, Cycle Kids has helped the inner-city neighborhoods of Boston and New York begin to address the staggering problem of obesity. So far, Cycle Kids has reached 2,300 students who leave their class energized to talk with family and friends about what they've learned and experienced, and the program continues to grow. Cycle Kids not only makes kids' bodies healthier, it strengthens their minds. The curriculum now meets New York and Massachusetts state learning standards for physical education, reading comprehension, and math. By promoting good nutritional habits, practical and recreational exercise, and pollution-free transportation, Cycle Kids is helping both individuals and communities live more sustainable and healthy lives. Now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. M. Greg Block, author of the new book, The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Dr. Block is a physician, health policy expert, and legal scholar. Welcome, Dr. Block. You were a health policy advisor to President Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2008, and now you've written a book about why doctors are under pressure to ration care. How does what you're saying in the book relate to the health reform debates, where we heard, I think, probably a couple of summers ago, where people were up in arms about government death panels and the idea of rationing health care?
Well, I am thrilled that health reform has passed, and it's on track to being implemented. It's going to provide access to health care to more than 30 million Americans who have not had it. But the next huge step is to get a grip on costs. We just can't afford what we're spending now, and we can't afford the rate of increase in health care. Health care spending is the main driver behind long-term fiscal deficits that threaten to bring our country down. Threaten to undermine our not just our national security, but our prosperity. And so we're going to have to find ways to say no. Let me tell you about Sarah, not her real name. Sarah's a patient who I talk about in The Hippocratic Myth. She was an 82-year-old woman who was visiting her daughter and was admitted to the hospital with she suffered a massive heart attack, was rushed to the hospital while visiting her daughter, was taken to intensive care, and put on pressors, intravenous medications that artificially raise your blood pressure. Almost all of her heart was destroyed. She had what doctors call about a 10% ejection fraction. And doctors figured that her case was close to hopeless. And they told Sarah, and they told Sarah's daughter, that they didn't think pressing on was going to make sense. And meanwhile, they were spending tens of thousands of dollars every few days in the intensive care unit to keep her alive. As soon as the doctors delivered the dire prognosis, Sarah's daughter became upset. And the daughter then began paying close attention to clinical details, She questioned the doctors about their intentions. The docs, in turn, grew annoyed. One of the docs expressed that annoyance to the patient. According to colleagues, he came to Sarah's bedside and told her that she didn't have enough heart muscle to survive, and then said, "Have you ever stayed in a really expensive hotel like the Plaza? You know how expensive a room is? $600 to $800. Well, you know how expensive this room is? $10,000. Well, the daughter threatened to sue, demanded new doctors, and insisted that the staff go all out to keep her mom alive. And the doctors, worried about a lawsuit, did so. Then several weeks later, Sarah walks out alive, and she survives for another year or so. Now, what does the story underscore? Now, you could say it shows how we should never give up hope. You could tell a kind of romantic story about that, and it's a moving story. But the problem is that we can't afford to spend like that to try to keep every Sarah alive when the chances are so tiny. And in the real world, when we do spend like that, we're taking money away from community health programs, from prevention, from a whole bunch of other activities, from education for poor kids, from a whole bunch of other activities that government engages in that achieve a bigger bang for the buck. And we have to make those priority decisions. And doctors right now are on the front lines as the pressure mounts to make those decisions.
You know, Dr. Black, I think you raised about 100 issues probably with that story, which are all fascinating and important ones to follow up. But let me bring it down to a few. One, I think we should acknowledge what the Hippocratic Oath is, and your reference to it is the Hippocratic myth, certainly about protecting patients, about a relationship, patients where you stand beside them, fight for them, and fight for their interests, as you point out people trying to do and sometimes having difficulty doing in the current situation. But it also struck me about another discussion we've followed out with many people about the issue of shared decision making and the goal and the trend towards trying to have a shared decision making process in which patients and their families and people who know them, people who have a relationship with them, hopefully their primary care provider or people, other people who stand in that place, work with patients to come to a decision based on all the information that they have. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is shared decision-making one way out of this dilemma, or, and I think you alluded to this a little bit in your book, is it too much to ask people to make decisions when they're well about what will happen down the road when they're not well and all of a sudden it's reality, or conversely, to engage in shared decision-making when they may be too sick to be able to think clearly about what those options are? Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about that.
I think it's a really important part of the story, not just when people are well, but also when people are in dire straits, so long as they're able to be conscious and aware. And what's really a challenge for a doctor, and here's part of the alchemy of medicine, the art of medicine, what's really a challenge for the doctor is to have an individualized sense, a personalized sense of how much each patient and how much each family member is able and willing to hear. How able emotionally is each patient and each family member to participate in this process? I can remember once lifting off in an airliner from Buenos Aires, and the person I was traveling with got upset when the pilot said that the plane was extra heavy because of its load and the takeoff run was going to be especially long. And she said, "Well, you know, I prefer not to know that." And there are a lot of things that patients and family members prefer not to know, and the challenge for doctors is to not impose too much. But within those constraints, engaging patients in these decisions wins over trust. It's not just a matter of enhancing people's autonomy in clinical situations. And with greater trust may welcome a willingness to conserve resources that might only be used irresponsibly.
Dr. Block, a contributing factor to increase in healthcare spending is technology, and it sort of brings us back to the Sarah story. I'm sure that had a big impact on her turnaround. But as you noted, it's becoming more difficult for us to afford to pay for it. I guess 20% of our GDP is being spent on
getting health, close to that, yeah,
and heading up. But we don't want to halt technology. So talk to us a little bit about how we can make sure that new technology is being tested, not only for safety and effectiveness, but also for cost effectiveness.
I think the challenge is this. There's basically two kinds of medical technology that we're developing. We're developing technology that's in the realm of bioengineering and software that is astonishing in its elegance and its sophistication, and at the same time quite crude in what it biologically does. It replaces biological functions rather than curing them. And much of what we do in intensive care units is illustrative. We can intervene with left ventricular assist devices and other kinds of devices to substitute for what the body, as it breaks down, is less and less able to do. That's really expensive, not only because of the intellectual property protections that the developers of these technologies have, but because you really need quite highly trained personnel in order to operate the technologies, and you're continuing to operate them to replace what the body does. Whereas genuinely decisive technologies, and I'm looking back to Lewis Thomas's dichotomy between halfway technologies and decisive technologies. Genuinely decisive technologies, like in a prior day, the antibiotic revolution, perhaps in more recent years, the statins for control of cholesterol, they intervene in biological processes. Their elegance is of a different sort. It's a biological kind of elegance. They achieve, if not a cure, then an internal adjustment of our biology. They fix things, and they tend to be really cheap to operate. They're not nearly as fancy in terms of the electronics, but they make a bigger biological difference and they're cheaper. So the kind of scientific advance that leads to genuinely decisive technologies is what we ought to be encouraging with intellectual property protection and investment in research. The kind of advance that leads to much more expensive ways to achieve tiny marginal benefits is what we should not be encouraging. And that's the main thing, along with insurance, that's driving our soaring healthcare spending.
Well, I think you make a great point there, and we all hope for the decisive advances, whether in technology or in treatments, but there seems to be more of the maybe halfway technologies, as you described them, than the decisive ones that come forward. And certainly one of the hopes of health reform in reducing costs is trying to identify which medical procedures are the most effective and selectively eliminating care or procedures that don't have demonstrated clinical effectiveness. And to this end, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, that's part of the health reform law, sets out to do this with its 9-member board. And I understand that board includes patients, doctors, hospitals, drug makers, device makers, insurers, payers, health experts. So we've got everybody in there. Is this a meaningful step forward? Will this kind of group have the ability to really make those determinations? And going back to the central premise of your book around physicians' roles in fulfilling the Hippocratic Oath, would you support those decisions? Because as you make the point kind of compellingly, it really will help find out what doesn't work most of the time for most of the people, but it may miss those people who would have been helped.
Well, I think that the Outcomes Research Initiative in the health reform bill is a huge step forward. We need the data. The vast majority of clinical decisions that docs make today aren't based on science. We're probably not going to be able to swing this around to the point that most decisions are based on science, simply because patients vary so much. And there's a trade-off between doing effective science and having your scientific results being broadly applicable. But it's a huge step forward. We need to do this kind of research. I worry that the oversight board for this body is composed of industry stakeholders rather than independent researchers and scientists following a kind of NIH or Institute of Medicine model, but it is a big step forward. We're going to have to take the next step, though. That next step is saying no to new tests and treatments that this kind of research shows achieve only tiny benefits at great cost. Germany, England, and a number of other countries have begun to incorporate this concern into their decisions about treatments. But we so far haven't. It's become unspeakable. In Washington, both parties are ready to shout the R word, rationing the other side.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. M. Greg Block, author of the new book, The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. Dr. Block, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, not to be confused with iPad, is another hot-button issue on Capitol Hill right now. And Republicans and now some Democrats strongly oppose the advisory board, which was part of health reform and set up to recommend to Congress ways to control Medicare's growth. And I wonder what your thoughts are on this board, and could it help us get more financially stable? And how does it also tie back to different treatment modalities and looking at the evidence-based or the comparative research effectiveness that's going on in the arena right now?
Well, the IPAB is the Independent Payment Advisory Board is a really good example of exactly the cultural politics that we've been talking about. The unspeakability of the possibility of saying no to some beneficial care, the use of the R word, rationing. How can the Independent Payment Board achieve Medicare cost control? Well, through a variety of mechanisms, dramatically reducing doctors and hospitals' fees, new policies when it comes to what treatments are and are not paid for, a variety of mechanisms that have in common the creation of incentives to hold back on potentially beneficial care. In other words, to do the sort of thing that the doctors at Sarah's bedside felt should be done. And, of course, once we go down that path, there will be plenty stakeholders who represent different special interest groups and folks in politics. There will be plenty who will point out exactly this, that we're denying beneficial care. And so IPAB is of questionable political viability. But the Republicans are proposing they're proposing something that seems quite different but poses the same dilemma, the Ryan plan for controlling Medicare and Medicaid costs. Well, the Ryan plan would put Americans below age 55, at least, into private plans, giving them a voucher once they become eligible for Medicare. And then it would hike that voucher by an amount that's much lower every year than the extent to which health care costs rise. And so it would shift costs to individuals so they could be their own rationers, or incentivize health plans to offer really low-cost plans so that the voucher would cover the cost, and then those health plans would do the rationing. So basically any serious proposal for controlling Medicare spending has to involve saying no to some beneficial care, and that means that the R word can be pointed at it.
And Dr. Block, you've served on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Understanding and Eliminating Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare. And as we think about this issue of rationing healthcare, we, of course, have to be very concerned that we don't lose any of the gains that we've made, which are imperfect, even as they are, to try and address some of the historic disparities in delivering health care or making health care available to racial and ethnic minorities. As you look at this issue, how are you thinking about that, and how do we protect those gains in an evolving picture where we have limited resources?
I fear that we're going to go in the opposite direction, that we're going to fail to protect those gains. And the reason for my fear is this, that health care continues to soar in cost relative to what everything else costs and what Americans are earning. Governments are already setting limits, and will be setting more severe limits, whether they do so in Democratic or Republican ways, more severe limits on what they'll pay. And so my fear here is that we're going to have more tiering of healthcare access by wealth than ever before. And I should point out, it's not just a matter of income, it's also a matter of wealth. Members of minority groups, especially African Americans, who have the same income, have dramatically different levels of wealth. The African American family that's earning, say, $80,000 a year, on average, has much less wealth than the white family that's bringing in $80,000 a year. So if the co-pays are rising, if the employee contributions towards health insurance premiums are rising, if Medicare beneficiaries have to pay more and more of the cost of both their care and their insurance, then inevitably you're going to have less well-off people going into different health plans with lower tiers of care. And at this point, I think it's going to be very difficult to avoid this. And I wish there were a whole lot more talk about this issue when cost control plans are discussed.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. M. Greg Block, author of The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. Dr. Block, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Telemedicine has resulted in improved cost savings for the Department of Defense and increased access to care for personnel in the Army. Colonel Ron Porapatich, Deputy Director of the Telemedicine and Advanced Technology Research Center at the U.S. Army Medical Research and Materiel Command, has been working with telemedicine in the Army since 1992 to implement it on a larger scale in both stateside and overseas locations.
I deployed to Somalia in January of 93, and so from my initial deployments of doing telemedicine in Somalia in 93 and 94, we've taken it to Haiti, then we've taken it to Croatia, Macedonia, Bosnia, then from there Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait.
But today, according to Porapatich, one of the most important healthcare tools for soldiers could be their cell phones.
I think we're pretty far ahead compared to others in the civilian sector right now is the use of cell phones in healthcare called mobile health, and how we're using that for telemedicine consults.
The Army Research Center is working on around 7 active projects in this area. A major one is called MCARE, a cell phone messaging system that allows injured guardsmen and reservists to provide daily feedback to their case managers. The system also stores the responses and charts the patient's progress, and through its secure network, it can send out appointment reminders, unit announcements, and wellness tips. Much like telemedicine, having the data stored centrally also means that if a case manager leaves on vacation, for example, his temporary replacement could see a patient's history and provide the necessary care. And with a budget of over $450 million a year in federally funded research in advanced medical technology, the Army Research Center is able to take it one step further and study the effect of these cell phone applications on the health of the patients through randomized control clinical trials.
We're not only developing apps, we're doing the kinds of hard science that you need to do to really show the value added with identified outcome-based metrics.
Porapatich says this is where the Army's mobile health efforts are making significant strides. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that was created in the late 1950s, brought many breakthrough technologies to the world. Hopefully, advances in mHealth from the Department of Defense will benefit civilian life in a similar way.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting. In partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.